Hello, I'm Allison Raskin. I'm a writer, mental health advocate, and co-host of the podcast Just Between Us.
What a coincidence. I'm Gabe S. Dunn. I'm a writer, bisexual icon, wink, and I'm also the co-host of this show.
Just Between Us is a variety show where we interview fascinating people, play a ridiculous game called Hypotheticals, and talk about things that affect everyone or maybe sometimes just me.
We also do a show called Too Long, Did Read It, which is a show where we scour the depths of Reddit to find the weirdest, kookiest, most upsetting posts, and then give our opinions.
So if you're looking for a new show to check out that goes from silly to serious in the same episode, often multiple times,
back and forth from each of us,
you can check out the Just Between Us feed, where we have over 200 episodes waiting just for you.
200 episodes?
I know, we've been doing this a long time.
And it were very funny.
Okay.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Good, then I'm closing GarageBand. Don't save.
Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks, as always, for making your way here, checking out the series, this episode. I do hope you hit the subscribe button so you can keep up with all the interviews that we put out every single week, a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to keep you up to date on your favorite artists, discover some new ones, know what's happening in the music world. At all the usual spots like iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, Podchaser, NPR, YouTube for the video versions, or again, anywhere you get your podcasts from. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, I get to talk with Amy Mann, one of my all-time favorite singer-songwriters. Got a new record called Queens of the Summer Hotel. It's an album that serves as the musical accompaniment to an upcoming stage adaptation of Girl Interrupted. We get to discuss the heavy subject matter, her own experiences with depression and mental health, dissociation, spending time in a treatment center, and how it all relates to the characters and lyrics within the songs. Now, Amy is also going to tell us about the freeing nature of writing stage music, directing the music towards the Burt Bacharach period of the late 60s, and duetting on Badfinger's Name of the Game on Susanna Hoff's new album, which we talked about with Susanna in a recent previous episode. So let's do this on the subject of Queens of the Summer Hotel. It's Kyle Meredith with Amy Mann.
Hello.
I was just thinking it's been since 2012 since you and I last did an interview. So, my life is better today because you have new music and I get to talk with you once again.
Thank you. It seems like yesterday.
Doesn't it? Right.
Yeah.
Funny enough, though, I will point out real quick, though, I was talking with Susanna Hoffs just last week for an interview, and it was like a love fest of how much we both love your art and music. So,
extremely nice. You know, Susanna is the nicest person in show business.
Yeah. And for those of you who haven't heard it yet, you did a duet on her new record, a covers record, with a cover of Name of the Game. And it really is fantastic.
It's the greatest song. Yeah, it's my favorite Badfinger song. And, you know, I mean, I like it because, of course, it's incredibly sad.
Not a lot of people know it. Like, it's not one of the obvious ones, too.
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, I remember hearing it on the radio at the time. So, you know, it got out there a little bit, but, you know, it wasn't as big as like Baby Blue.
Anyway, you all do fantastic job of that one. No surprise. And I'll bring it back around because you've got this new record and, you know, you made the joke comment there about, you know, liking it because it's sad. And I think that's sort of part of what we're talking about, too, because you have what is a heavy record. I don't really want to call it a sad record, but it is a heavy record. But what you've done with it, it's just gorgeous and even at times fun to listen to.
Thank
does that
you.
Sound like an okay compliment?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean,
You know, I think that there's nothing, for me as a listener, it's to listen to that something that is sad, but feels like that it's real to the writer and that it's accurate is like, that's very uplifting. I don't feel it, that it doesn't bring me down. I mean, bad music or badly written song brings me down more than that does.
So let's get the story on this, because this isn't just a normal album. This is connected to something else. And I wonder if you would give us the story there of where this album came from. How did it start?
I was approached, I mean, probably 4 or 5 years ago, I was approached to write music for a stage presentation of Girl Interrupted, like based on the book, not the movie. I think they bought the rights to the book, and they particularly, one of the producers really had a very personal relationship with the book. And so they had a writer and a director, and they wanted to get this team together to figure out a stage presentation. And so I got the book and just immediately, I mean, obviously this is really up my alley, right? But almost more than usual, I think because it was so interesting to me to have a project that kind of like, yes, was in my wheelhouse. I mean, obviously my last record was called Mental Illness. So like that, you know, is a topic that is of interest to me, but that to write from material that comes from somewhere else is a really interesting, you know, it's like a fun puzzle. Like you do put a lot of yourself into it, but at the same time to try to be, you know, to try to put yourself into the mindset of the character, you know, a lot of which is the narrator, the woman who wrote it, Susanna Kaysen, you know, to think like, well, what could, you know, when she's saying this, the, you know, this bit of narrative, what else could I bring to that? Like what, you know, or how could I, what is the music bed that suggests? Like all that kind of, all those questions are very, it's very interesting to me. And it's a real, like, it's a real fun puzzle. So I just started writing like a madman, and, you know, kind of outstripped, like, I'm actually not even sure if there's a finished script. So I'm not sure what, you know, if they want to make it a musical or just to play with music, like probably the latter, it seems to be leaning. But I have no idea. So it's just like, here's a bunch of music, you know, do whatever you want to with it.
It's interesting, especially the puzzle. It sounds like it's even more of a puzzle, especially to if it's not finished, to put it together in the end. But for you, like you've written, you know, been on soundtracks plenty of times before in the past, but how different in the way you would write a pop song, I'll use broadly, is it then how you would write these? Because even a song like Chex, which does get a reprise, but even then, I think you put them together and it's still under a minute and a half. Like there, I don't know. Is there that itch? Like, is this song done? Because it can just finish, right?
Yeah. I like that, you know, there's some of them are very short and, you know, and that's because you can flesh that out on stage. You can flesh that out with, you know, instrumental passages that have movement, or, you know, obviously if other things need to happen, if somebody else needs to sing or needs to sing something else, you know, you can add to it. But, you know, sometimes I would write it and go, that's all this character had to say at this, you know, like in this particular sitting. And there, like, that is very liberating. I think, harmonically, I felt like I could try different things than I would usually. I wrote on piano, which I don't usually do. So, you know, there's a lot, harmonically, it's more, you know, they're more sort of seventh chords and ninth chords and that kind of thing. Because, you know, mostly because I can't play that on a guitar, like, cause I'm not a very good guitar player. So, you know, and also if I thought like, well, right here, it just wants to stop and have like a totally different tempo change. And like, that's not the kind of thing you do in a pop song either. So it was very liberating. Like I could just do whatever I want, you know? And also the idea that somebody else would sing it. So I didn't feel like I necessarily had to write for my voice. Oops. Like, and then, you know, then when I finished, you know, had a number of songs, I was like, oh, I kind of want to make a record out of this. So I sort of, you know, screwed myself over in that regard. Like there's some things are like, oh, this is way higher than I thought I would ever sing.
since the book, if I remember, or at least the movie does at least take place in the 60s, right? So, I mean,
yeah, how
much did the era then also sort of direct musically, as you're talking, like you're talking about like those minor notes and everything, but like I was trying to remember what song, and I know I wrote I See You. Like the mood of that is so perfect to me in that era. Like how much of that era directed how you wrote the music?
It did. You know, I'm not super great at writing, you know, like I can't necessarily replicate another era, but I can think about it and listen to that music from that time. I wanted it to sound like 1968, but not really rock music, like not rock, not Woodstocky. More sort of that Burt Bacharach, Jimmy Webb, like that, you know, that era, that and Sinatra, that was also going on, you know. So there's kind of like a bossa nova, you know. It's there's more, you know, what I grew up with, which we called more easy listening, but you know, that the swing waltz is very Bacharach-y. And, you know, has filtered through me because I'm no Burt Bacharach, but that was, you know, that's the kind of thing I was shooting for.
I feel like you're pretty close to this era's Burt Bacharach in a lot of ways, but but no, you, seriously, and the compliments on that, like you really did nail that feeling, because that's instantly the mood. I mean, his name, of course, is the one that always comes top of mind when you're talking about that music, but it instantly did come top of mind. So just the easy compliments right there.
Oh, thank you so much. That means a lot to me. I really appreciate it. I mean, you know, I try.
So you mentioned this a minute ago. Obviously, your last record did deal with similar themes on mental illness. And as you said, you know, there are parts of you, you know, that find its way in. But was there ever that dividing line, like, that's too much of me, it needs to be more the character?
No, because I always started with the character, or, you know, the character or the situation. And, you know, sometimes like the song Suicide is Murder, I wanted to put more of me in, because it does come from a narrative in the book, and where she is talking about her own suicide attempt and what she felt like her mindset had to be in order to attempt suicide. And it was a little like, there's a little bit of almost like, I'm kind of tongue in cheek, you know, here's what you got to do, like a how to. And then I just, as I was writing, I've like became uncomfortable with that, because I do, you know, I mean, I've known people who have committed suicide, and it's just so terrible, like to, you know, to know people, and, you know, I mean, just always blame yourself on, like, even if you don't know somebody that well, you always blame yourself on some level, and it really does leave such a trail of devastation. So you know, so I kind of wanted to put more of myself in that song.
That's first off, we've loved playing at WFPK, like heavy rotation for a song like that. You don't usually get the opportunity to do.
Heavy is the emphasis.
We do these Mental Health Wednesdays, where it's an all request day on Wednesdays at WFPK, and it's sort of you know, to give people hope, especially that have had to deal with, you know, just whatever the situation might be when we talk about mental health. But a song like that, we don't usually get something so direct. And I think it is very helpful when you're writing that. And there was a review, and I apologize, I don't remember who it was, but they said it's almost like you had to separate yourself. Like you, like as the way you sing it, like there's distance from being too emotionally invested, or whoever that is talking, I should say. Like, and I think you were getting at that, but as you're writing that, like, do you have to have that distance in order to write it in that way?
I think that's probably easier to have that distance if you're starting with a book, or you're starting with an idea about what a character could be. I mean, not every song kind of comes directly from the book, but most of them. And so it's easier. I mean, and it's funny because you know, I definitely have moments where I'm writing something thinking it's about somebody else, you know, because it is about somebody else, and then suddenly realize like, oh, this is, you know, exactly the thing I went through. So, I mean, it is strange to have that experience, but the singing of it, my idea, you know, my sort of concept of a singer versus a song is that that I'm telling the story and I want you to listen to the story. I don't want to be selling you the story and telling you how to feel about it by being really emotional. you know, or showboaty, because I feel like that gets in the way. And I, you know, I just like want, I want you to listen to the song. That's mostly, you know, cause that's, I don't know. That's what I really like is I'm really into songwriting. Yeah. The singer is just kind of the messenger.
Well, I don't know many people that could make the words premeditated rehearsed tragedy catchy. What a line.
That's so funny.
Yeah. And I don't know if you can spit, like, do you remember like when that happened specifically, like that line? Because I get really caught on that one every time the song comes on.
Well, that is from the book. I mean, I think, you know, and Suicide is a Murder is also from the book. It's just that, you know, when I read that, I was like, I have to put that to music. Like, you know, obviously, and I have to make that the premeditated, like I have to make that work somehow. I have to figure out how to make that work. So, you know, yeah, I can't take total credit, but like it definitely did not. There is something that's very fun in figuring out how to make something that does not sound at all like it should be in a song to work in a song.
It's again, just that little bounce just does everything for it. You know, it's this is what it does. Disassociation mm-hmm. is something that I just started learning about, actually, as the phrase and everything. What role does that play in the narrative? Because I also feel like we're talking a little bit about that when, you know, when we were in Suicide is Murder.
Yeah, there's an episode that happens in the book where Susanna Kaysen has this really severe episode of like depersonalization or dissociation, and something that I've experienced. So, you know, so there's definitely stuff that has, for this, that has come from my own experience. About 20 years ago, I spent some time in a treatment center because, you know, I mean, PTSD was my diagnosis, but it was really like an old timey nervous breakdown sort of. And so dissociation was definitely a part of that. So I 100% understood what that, you know, what that felt like and what that, you know, what that dynamic is like.
A lot of artists use that whole line. I don't mean to paint that like negatively. They use the line that songwriting is like therapy. And I've been curious, like for you, do you see this songwriting actually help you with any of this, or is it more of a timestamp?
I think that it's helpful to really describe what's going on, because there is, like, I've actually read this, that there's, that when you tell the truth about something, that there is like, you know, you get sort of, I don't, endorphins, that's not the word, or dopamine, I'm not sure what, you know, like, but there is sort of like a chemical reaction that happens in your brain that makes you feel better. And I think that's what it is for me, that there's, that songwriting is about describing, and describing sometimes a very complicated mindset or state of mind or feeling set. And the music is part of the description, right? Like when you have a piece of music and you're like, oh, that sounds like this thing that is happening to me or this thing that I feel. And so it's very satisfying in that way. It's just to put a name, not even a name sometimes, but like you put an analog to it and then you have this analog and you're like, oh, that's how I feel. This song is how I feel. It sort of sums it up. Even if it's not describing what happened to you necessarily, there's something about it that's an analog for what's going on. And that is really, really satisfying. And also just the act of doing it, I think now more than it used to be, because it is, I don't know, it's easier for me. So it's easier for me to slip into it. So I feel like it's more fun, you know, like it's more fun to do the crossword puzzle when there's a chance that you can finish it. Like, it's not that fun when you're like, I got three clues. Great. So I think just the puzzle of it and the doing of the puzzle is like very exciting.
Well, and I would imagine too, the opportunity to help someone. I mean, you know, the way people say, this song saved my life. Like when you're having songs like this, it really seems like you have a real great chance of connecting with someone as well.
I hope so, but you never know. And you kind of have to let go of the result, you know, and just put yourself out there and you know, how it hits people is it, you can't really control it. You know, I mean, as in everything, you know, you can't control, you know, you send somebody an email, you have the best of intentions, they're somehow offended by it. Like, you can't really control it. You just have to, you know, sometimes you just have to hit send and hope for the best.
The album ends on You're Lost and I See You. As an album, where are we left?
The last song is, I mean, this is my idea. I don't know if this is going to happen in the actual stage production, but my idea was that the cast would sort of turn to the audience and talk about, you know, sort of witness the people that are definitely somewhere in the audience who are struggling with these things and naming these things and saying, I get it. I see it. And I know what that's like.
Is there going to be opportunity for you eventually when this all happens and gets completed to be on the stage with these folks playing this live?
I don't think that's how it's going to go down. Like, but I don't know. Who knows? It's you never know what happens. Things can take unexpected twists and turns. That would be very fun actually to do. And I've thought about having a stage version where I talk about the record and, you know, sort of read passages from the book, but I don't know. And that I also don't want to tread on the, you know, the producer's toes, like, you know, when they have their own thing going on. So who knows? It could happen. I hope so.
Well, either way, I'm looking forward to seeing how you do represent some of these songs live. I'm assuming they make them into your live show.
Yeah. We've already played them live. They sound great.
Yeah. I want to hear that. So especially if you drop in those little like checks or something like that, like it just seems like a weird little moment in a normal concert. I think
yeah. That's funny. We don't, but that's a good idea. That's an interesting idea. I like the idea of just these little interstitial moments.
Well, all of my compliments on this. Again, Queens of the Summer Hotel. It's such an interesting, different kind of piece, to jump into. And I know it, you know, is not the typical album, but, you know, listening to it top to bottom isn't any different. So I do love it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And hopefully it won't be another 10 years before we do this again. Amy, thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Take care. All right. Bye.
As we mentioned in the interview, the last time Amy and I really got to talk music was back in 2012 when she just released her LP Charmer. Thought I'd also include that interview here. Take a little trip back in time, nearly a decade. It's part two of Kyle Meredith with Amy Mann. Really, really did enjoy the new video to Charmer, too.
Oh, thank you.
So you've got this whole robot thing going on. At this point, in the theme of the video, and it fits the theme of the song with Charmer and everything, but is it a hassle to go out? Is it a hassle? Because you have been doing this now for a few decades, you know,
yes.
So you definitely know the route, you know, the game, and it's just like, you know, every 2 years or whatever it is, you know, here you're back on the trail. So it almost seems like, you know, Bob Dylan can't get off tour. He just can't. He can't sit still.
It's he's addicted to it. It's different for me for sure. I think at this point, you know, over time, you just have to figure out what works for you and what doesn't work for you. You know, when I was part of the sort of major label system, obviously they just want you to get out and flog the record as long as possible with no interruptions and do every single thing that comes down the pike. And I finally start, you know, like when I started my own label and got off that system and realized I could, you know, I could tour in a way that made sense for me. And I like to, you know, I kind of need a break after 3 weeks because tour time doesn't feel like real time. You know, a week feels like a month. It's, you know, because you're essentially working around the clock, you know, it's not just playing for 1 hour. It's all the, you know, it's all the stuff that goes up to it, the travel, you know, enormous amounts of traveling, obviously, and you know, disruptions and it can be an adjustment for some people. You know, I'm a more of, you know, a little more of a hothouse flower than other musicians. So, you know, so I just have to be careful.
Right.
So I, you know, I know how to structure a tour and in a way that makes it as workable as possible. And I think, you know, not having the pressure of a label constantly, you know, pressuring you to do stuff is very helpful.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I tell my manager, like, look, you can't do everything. I mean, there's, you know, some stuff, it's great to, you're in town, there's press to do, you can go to a radio station and play. But, you know, if you're playing a show, I mean, you got to go, you got to pick your job, you know, I mean, you can't do,
sure,
you can't do like, you know, three different jobs in a day because they're going to suffer.
And you've talked about acting and what you have to take on to be in a movie or a TV show or whatever it is, but there is that other persona, which also gets hit on in this video, but the other persona, yeah, of being on stage, of being Amy Mann, the musician, the public figure. How different is it?
Well, it's not super different, but when you know people are looking at you regarding you in a certain way, it definitely affects you. I mean, it's a little strange. And then you do start to feel that you know, as Joe Henry said, like you don't, you know, want to walk past that and set fire to it mm-hmm. in some way. So, you know, and that does put you in a kind of a strange mindset to then sort of worry about how you are coming across, you know, like if you're leaving, you know, after a show and you're leaving the building, and you're super tired, but there are people who want to, you know, stay and talk to you and have stuff signed. And, you know, like you don't want to come across in a certain way. But, you know, I mean, even that sort of very small, you know, small example, you know, you don't want people to think badly of you. Or you don't want people to feel bad. You don't want to hurt people's feelings. But at the same time, you might be like, I'm exhausted. And if I don't get to bed, I don't know if I'm going to be able to play the show the next day.
Right.
So, you know, it's weird to weigh these things just in, you know.
It's an odd life.
It's a very
different life.
It is.
Plumbers don't
weird.
Have this life.
It's weird. And it's easy to get caught up in, you know, once you realize people regard you in a certain way, then you feel like you do have to develop a bit of a persona just to have as an inner, you know, just to protect your privacy, really. Mm. I mean, to protect, you know, protect yourself. But then it's a short walk to being a big, you know, like being a big constructed personality that's a huge phony.
Right.
So, you know, you don't want to go there. So you do walk a very weird line sometimes.
Yeah. At this point, you've done a few records that are themed. More or less, is that something you actually look for now? Do you have to theme a record to make a record? Are you able just to sit down and suddenly you've said, "Oh my, I've written 12 songs. I might as well record these and make an album."
It's, you know, I think I wouldn't mind having themed records because for me having a structure is almost more creatively freeing than, hey, here's your blank page, do whatever
right.
you want. I, in the case of this record, it's just that I happen to sort of be thinking about the same thing and it would crop up in different ways.
Yeah.
And not every song is, you know, I mean, it's the record's called Charmer and, you know, there are several songs that kind of explore the idea of charm and charming people and narcissism and, you know, kind of what that means and how I interact with people I know who are like that. You know, not every song is about that. So it's semi-themed.
Yeah. And the other thing, just seeing you, you know, album by album by album, throughout everything, is that you haven't fallen to, you know, in some of the pits that so many other musicians do, where I don't know what it is. As you get older as a musician, by the way, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Yeah, happy birthday. But as you get older, it just seems, as musicians get older, where does the fire go? You know, why does the fire go out? Why were they such an electric songwriter in their youth? But, you know, as they reach middle age or middle career or anything, and it just becomes bland and they start falling back on the blues in such
yeah.
a bad way, you know.
Ooh.
And yeah, right. But you haven't, you know. And here you are, you know, we're talking about being creative and being in thematic. And just going for different sounds. I mean, you were talking about that in our previous interview, too, about, you know, just when someone says, make it sound different, and you're trying
yeah.
to figure out how to do that and everything, which, you know, all that aside, you're actually thinking about it, and you're actually trying, and it's not just falling back. You know, why, and this is maybe not even an answerable question, but why are you able to do that? Why haven't you fallen into those traps that all of those other musicians have?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for saying that. And I hope you're not just being flattering. I mean, that's, you know, what any songwriter, I think, wants to hear, that they're getting better. I mean, I feel like I'm getting better sort of based on my own standards of what better is, which is, you know, I mean, for me, the I really like the craft of songwriting. I try, you know, there's certain things about lyric writing that I think I've gotten better at, but you know, I mean, those are to a certain standard. So like, you know, maybe other people don't have those standards and wouldn't read it as better necessarily. I mean, you know, if you stay interested and if you are connected emotionally to what you're doing, you know, hopefully things, I don't know, like hopefully things do get better. But I think also some of that is like a matter of perception, because, you know, if somebody's really young and they're writing what feel like heartfelt songs with a certain amount of skill and interest, it's just more, I mean, because it's almost like more fascinating because it's so unlikely. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, being really good and insightful and understanding and having better craftsmanship, I mean, is something that just comes with age and experience. And so when you see, I mean, it's like somebody like Fiona Apple, who at 17 was writing really unbelievably great lyrics and like deep, you know, deeply insightful, mm-hmm. interesting imagery, just so completely mature that it was almost spooky.
Right.
And so like there is like that thing of like, what is going on? You know, like there's a huge mystery to it, and it because it doesn't make sense.
Right.
And then that same song in a 35-year-old or a 45-year-old might just be like, oh, this is pretty good.
Yeah, right.
So I don't know. Like maybe it's a matter of perception. I'm not sure.
Hopefully it's not just that. I mean, hopefully a good song is a good song.
I hope so.
Like I have faith in that. You know, that a good song is a good song.
I would like to have faith in that.
Well, there's plenty of bad songs out there. Don't get me wrong. We're not talking about this. You've written plenty of great songs. Thank you so much, Charmer.
Thank you.
I've heard about half of it so far, and it's a great record. I'm looking forward to hearing the other half and everything that's yet to come.
That second half is pretty great.
Even better than the first.
Can't believe I'm selling myself. Come on, man. Listen to the second half. You won't be sorry.
All right, Amy Mann, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead. Download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
Amy Mann there from 2012 talking about her album Charmer. Now, it was just like a month or two right before that. Amy was in town in Louisville, I should say, where I'm based, shooting a movie called Pleased to Meet Me. She stopped in the FPK studio and brought a couple of her co-stars, the songwriters Joe Henry and Karen Berkowitz from Over the Rhine. One of the coolest moments of my career at that point. We sat down to talk, discuss, debate, relate, laugh, cuss, decide, kill some time on a Friday morning. Really, really was a special, special moment. So I'm going to include that here as well. Part three of Kyle Meredith with Amy Mann, as well as with Joe Henry and Karen Berkowitz. It's 91.9 WFPK Radio Louisville, Kyle Meredith, and this might be one of the greatest days in my life. Surrounded by amazing musicians, oh, to the left of me, to the middle of me, to the right. Let's go to Joe Henry is in the studio, Amy Mann, and Karen Berkowitz. Did I say your name right? Because I always look at that.
You do.
Can
you
start off with an apology.
It's an appropriate English pronouncement, which is fine.
Well, it is awesome to have you guys in here. Thank you so much for being here today.
We're delighted to be here.
Thank you so much.
You've all been in Louisville actually for, I don't know, what, week, couple weeks?
Week and a half.
Yeah, about a week and a half. Yeah. Seems like a month. I don't mean it that way.
Things go really slow here. Thanks.
It's purely because of the movie. We're doing such long hours. Yeah. It has that, you know, it's like tour time where, mm-hmm. where a week becomes a month. Mm-hmm. But we're in love with this town.
Mm-hmm. That's what I like to hear.
It's unbelievable. It's a crazy little utopia. I'm just waiting for the bubble to be burst.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, keep it coming.
I mean, we're... we're beyond thrilled with Louisville.
What you're talking about, you're out here shooting a movie, actually. This is a bit of a different element. I mean, there is history with movies and TV here, but you're shooting a movie called Pleased to Meet Me, with Archie Borders directing.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. This is based off a This American Life episode, right? It's called Everybody Speaks Elton.
Mm-hmm. That was the original broadcast episode, yeah.
Yeah. So what's the story? Give us the dummy.
Okay. You looked at me when you said that. Give me the dummy interpretation. I think the shorthand story is that a woman who's a producer enlists the help of her ex-partner, who's a, you know, regional rock star who didn't quite break through. And they have this concept together of an experiment where they put a band together of completely disparate characters, right. You know, people who have no history together personally or musically, don't come from similar musical backgrounds, take them into the studio for a single day and have to come out with a recorded song. So it's just sort of a, you know, what can we do with this,
sure,
you know, in this window of time if we all sort of, you know, serve the same goal. And
it can fail miserably.
Wildly.
I was promised by Archie that this would not fail miserably, that yes. This was going to make all of us look, you know.
Well, I did mean the songwriting, but just the same. So how did you all get involved then? How did everybody arrive in this?
Because Joe Henry.
Joe Henry.
He's the hub around which this whole
when Joe says,
wheel
do
turns.
This, you do it.
Yeah.
No. You know, kind
can't
of.
Say no to Joe. Yeah. It's very hard. We've tried. I just tried it about 15 minutes ago, and it was really hard.
That was, will you come into the radio station, right? Thanks, Joe.
Well, again, the short version of that story is that my brother David lives in your lovely city, and he's a writer, and Archie enlisted his help to work on the screenplay. And they approached me about, for one, doing some music production for the film. And at first had asked me if I would take the lead role of the film, which I wouldn't do. I didn't think I could do it. I didn't believe I could be that character. I didn't think I was that character. But I still wanted to be involved, and I thought that the smartest way for me to be involved was to stack the deck with, you know, my friends and loved ones, and then, you know, and then I could, you know, be like a big net that I could jump into. So based on my wife's suggestion, I threw out John Doe's name to play the lead, and Amy as his counterpart, the female lead in the film. And then once they were in place, it was easy to kind of see who else might, you know, take on the other roles, and then I could understand how it might be a feasible vehicle.
What's it's such a cool concept too, and there's something that Archie actually says in his Kickstarter video, because there was a bit of this movie that was funded by Kickstarter, which is always great to see people come through and actually believe in a project like that. But he said he didn't want actors playing rockers, but rockers who could act.
Mm. Well, you know, the three of us didn't necessarily know if we could act.
Right.
But, there are two in our camp who are real actors and were beforehand, and you have none of them in the room this morning. Yes.
Right.
Sorry to say.
We're talking about John Doe and
Lon Wainwright.
Yeah, you have the amateurs, but I think we all sort of felt, first of all, if somebody asks you to be in a movie, you have to say yes. If Joe Henry is in that movie and is part of it, you additionally have to say yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we all got sort of shamed into, well, wait a minute, you're gonna consider saying no just because you're scared to do it?
Right.
Yeah, it was my daughter who said that, actually.
Right.
She said, you're not really going to say no to this just because you're afraid, are you?
Right.
Called
nailed,
out.
Nailed yeah, to the no wall. Kidding.
Called out. So I'm really here just as an example to my children. I have no other expectations.
He is fantastic. He's fantastic. And as he will tell you, time after time, he was voted best thespian of the year two times in a row in high school.
37 years ago. And I parked it right there. I said, you know, I don't want this to go bad. I'm going to put it in the deep freeze, and someday I'll need to take it out.
When he played, when he played Linus in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, he really...
I played him as Lee J. Cobb. I'm sorry, we are a little bit... punch drunk.
No. Let's keep that.
You're
going to
clean this all up later. I know you will.
Let's keep that mood going. But I think you all are being modest, obviously. Joe, you've been around movies for a while. Amy, yourself, you've even lately dabbled with Portlandia.
She's in the Big Lebowski.
You are in the Big Lebowski. That's true.
I'm in the Big Lebowski for literally two seconds.
Yeah.
I do it in a different language. And the character is a nihilist, which I interpreted to mean need express zero emotion. Need express no emotion. I think it's a double negative.
It's amazing how many references we kept coming back to Louisville, because this is just a huge Lebowski town on top of it, you know. Mm-hmm. Karen, have you done any acting before this?
Absolutely not. And if you, I don't think college counts. So, you know, there was a little bit of, you know, dabbling.
Hey, I was counting high school a minute ago.
Yeah, you counting high school.
Well,
I was in your good man, Charlie Brown, by the way.
Perhaps you might. I might not count mine, but anyway. But no, nothing in front of the.
I did enough to know that I was a terrible actor. And I mean, I really, you know, I did enough to go like, man, acting's hard. Yeah. I couldn't imagine how anybody did it. And I did a little bit of just sort of improv stuff with, you know, with Fred Armisen and Carrie in Portlandia. But like, you play yourself. You don't have to memorize lines. And honestly, like to play the straight man who just looks bewildered and dumb is not, you know, like that's a lot easier. But,
so what, like music videos, though? I mean, have you ever done concept music videos? Don't you have to be a character in that?
Isn't there a sense of acting is pretty low.
Yeah, it's not like memorizing lines and getting into a character, really.
I don't think that's like having to embody a character other than your own and be authentic, you know, in that role to other people. I think that's really, really different. Yeah. And that was certainly my apprehension is, you know, can I disappear into a character in some way that's, you know, in service to Archie's story? Mm-hmm. I wasn't completely sure I could. I mean, I have done enough acting way back to think I understand, you know, what needs to happen. I just didn't think that I had the tools to do it necessarily. Sure. But, you know, once John Doe was aboard, he's a really, really old friend and a friend of Amy's as well. And, he's really no nonsense, and he's really candid. And he and Amy both came to my house in California when Archie and Dave and a producer and cameraman, Mike Fitzer, came out for a reading. And I said, you know, I'm only going to take this role if John says that I can, because, you know, I'm playing off of him. He's the lead. I'm sort of his sidekick in a way. And I knew that if we did the reading and he didn't think I could actually do it in a credible and, you know, respectful way, that he would tell me. Mm-hmm. And
here you are.
And here I am.
Yeah. I gave him plenty of outs. I'm like, look, if this doesn't sound good, feel free to tell me.
You guys are really selling this. Everything about this buildup so far is, don't want to do it. Fine.
Well, I did want to do it. I was looking for a reason to be able to do it.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do it. I mean, quite honestly, you know, all of us have invested a lot in some kind of creative public persona. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants to just, you know, walk by and set fire to it.
Nobody wants to be Mariah Carey's glitter is what this is coming down to.
So, I mean, honestly, if we're just, you know, if we're being frank, I didn't want to do it if I couldn't be good.
Nobody wants
to go out there and embarrass themselves and the project. And I just needed to be convinced that I could hold up my end of things and that, you know, that Archie would be as tough as he needed to be to get what he needed. And then he wouldn't, you know, be shy with any of us. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that he's appreciative that we're here. And I didn't want that to override the fact that, you know, there's a job to do. And it can't be about, you know, are we comfortable right now? And is he uncomfortable, you know, having to say, you know, I need you to do that again and do it different. But I have to say that having both John and Loudon on board, you know, they're real actors. And
so you're able to help each other out.
Well, it's
John,
just that
John's been very helpful.
Sure.
To us. Yeah.
But it's just like being in a, you know, in a band with somebody who's really good. It pulls everybody up.
Yeah.
You know, and you if anybody who's in a scene with Loudon, even if you're in the room while a scene's happening, you know, what he does with two words, you know, it's a constant sort of realignment of your thinking of what's possible rather than just thinking, you know, I have to somehow overpower the script with, you know, a big concept of who my character is.
Sure.
You know, he just distills something really quickly and really authentically. And every time I watch him do that, I'm sort of, you know, I get realigned.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a big thing. And Archie's notion of having, you know, musicians who can act versus actors who can play musicians, especially in something that's as kind of communal, you know, this is a real sort of an ensemble piece in a way, even though Amy and John's characters are the focal point of the story. It's really hard for musicians to watch people play musicians who aren't really, you know. There are people I could name, and I won't, who have been in films playing, you know, great actors playing musicians.
Punch drunk now? That's well, what I
do. You know, we just don't look, you know, in one, even if in the most subtle way, you know, just burst the bubble for you. And you say, I know that that person has practiced and had a coach, but they are clearly not, you know, a real musician. They don't play that instrument. Right. And it really deflates the tires. And I think Archie's, you know, idea that, you know, that part of it has to be authentic or the whole thing will fall down. So to try to find people who could stand there and be true to that element of the story and yet still deliver a line when somebody says go.
Wasn't it amazing how hard it is to act naturally?
You know I was just talking to Karen about this. The thing that I'm finding, I mean, it's so, you know, I mean, it's a real indie film. It's you know, a bit guerrilla style. And there's so, you know, the hours are so long and there's so little time, you know, like when they're setting up a thing and you know, it's not unlimited takes that you don't really have time to be self-conscious and worry about it. Just like, you know, I'm going to improv. It's going to happen. I don't necessarily know what I'm doing, but here we go.
Here we go.
Yeah. So I think it's been easier. It's a lot easier than I thought. I mean, you know, me and Joe were really, that first scene that we did, we were pretty nervous, but I think we got over that really fast.
Yeah.
A lot of rehearsal before that? Before
no, not at all. Not at all. Because I just finished up a record, so I've been like, you know, trying to get that going. And, you know, I mean, everybody else is busy on
I've been on tour.
Yeah, you're
on.
That's the thing. Everybody has a life, you know, that is completely disconnected with acting. And we've got, you know, touring and recording and schedules and families. And so we really just had to find a little chunk of time when we could plow through this thing and make it happen. And
we just jumped in with both feet and hoped for the best.
It's amazing.
Blindfolded.
Yeah. And, you know, you just hope your director is like, you know, look, the director's going to have to look through the camera and tell me how it looks. And if it doesn't look good, you know, I'll do it some other way. But, you know, I mean, my thing, I feel very self-conscious about, quote, acting. And, and I just thought, I was like, you know what? I don't have time for that. I don't care. Let's go.
Right, right. And you kind of, you have to trust the people behind the camera, behind the lens, because there's no other.
Yeah, if they say it looks good, then let's,
that's like, okay, okay.
A big difference, though, I'll say from, you know, there's a lot of things about making a record and making a movie that are, you know, common. But there are a couple of key aspects that are really, really different. And the biggest one for me is, you know, I'm a record producer as well, which is analogous to being a film director. I mean, that's the sort of the same job. I don't know why they call it producing, not directing. But you do something and people are trusting you, and yet you still, you know, offer a playback and people listen and make comments about what they've just done, and everybody needs to be in some kind of agreement that, you know, this is what we meant to do, now let's move on, as opposed to, you know, acting in a scene and then you look up and Archie goes, hey, that's great, let's move on. And it's just like if we were making a record, if I was producing Karen or Amy and they do a take and say, I'm not going to play it back for you, but trust me, it's good. You're going to like your record when you hear it. That part of it's really different because you don't have anything to reference except that, you know, I trust Archie. And I think at this point I know, you know, when he's just got, you know, that's the best we're going to do versus that's really what I wanted. And I try to read that as best I can and make sure before we move on that, you know, is that, you know, as good as I can do? And is that really as good as you need it to be?
Well, it's interesting that you're talking about parallels, because, you know, some of the other parallels that go along, the movie is about, in a sense, collaborations, which is something you're all familiar with and everything. But to have something, to have something when you're thrown in, I mean, it's hard enough to make an organized band succeed.
But to have this this act, this band, whatever you call it, totally built on chaos, you know, in hopes that something's going to happen. I mean, have you ever actually been in any of those situations?
Well,
in
sometimes
chaos.
I mean, every touring band is kind of like that. I mean, you know, I've been really fascinated recently by the idea of group dynamics and what a weird mystery that is. And and you know, you just you add in one extra person or substitute one extra person, the whole thing changes. Right. And you really have to record, and you know this, Joe, because this is totally your thing, but you have to sense where the group needs to go and allow everybody to go there instead of coming in with a you know, an edict that you're trying to force and, you know, this group to go, you know, to match up with. It's fascinating. I mean, and just being part of the movie with all the players and the people. I mean, it's fascinating to see the group dynamics and, you know, amongst, you know, all of the actors.
But it's also important to note that what's happening in, you know, in real time on the set is germane to the narrative because, you know, the actors in this case are all musicians and they are coming from really, really different places. Mm-hmm. And they are actually, you know, we're asking them to really play the music. You know, it's not being created by someone, you know, somewhere else and then, you know, we're lip syncing to it or anything. The music that's happening in the movie is actually having to happen in our real little universe here, you know, as it does in the story. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had to, you know, try to find a way for us all to play together in some way that is musical. And it's not just about, you know, what I would personally like to hear if I was, you know, playing myself in real life and trying to direct, you know, a moment in a studio like this, because the song is a character in the story. And what it becomes has to, you know, have some kind of integrity that's rooted in the narrative. It's not just about what I want to hear.
Sure.
It's like, does this sound like what these people would sound like when they got there? Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm. So in a very meta sort of way, I mean, you guys are living the
really
real story
is,
in this. I mean, the whole thing is the real story.
It's unfolding before our very eyes.
Because they're players with varying degrees of, you know, styles and ability. And it is kind of fascinating to see. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Joe's sort of directing this too as the producer. But, you know, what is its best self that the group can be with these weird elements and sometimes very strange instrumentation too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when, you know, I was talking with Karen this morning about a vocal she did on a song the other day about the fact that, you know, I'm not saying that her performance was too good for the character, but it's accomplished in a way that is different than the character perhaps. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I bring that up to say that's sort of what we're wrestling with constantly is, you know, is that what that character would sound like? Mm-hmm. You know, not what is Karen capable of, but, you know, how can she believably embody, you know, where that character is, you know, along the arc of the story? Mm-hmm. And it's a tricky thing to cut loose some part of your own sensibility because we're all trained to say, this is what I mean and this is how what I need to get there versus, well, this is where I would go if, you know, if I was producing Karen Berkowitz singing this song, you know, I would approach it really, really differently than, you know, how do I approach the character that she's playing and how would she, you know, mount a song if she had to?
Mm-hmm. It's really hard to let go of, you know, years and years of what you have learned works for you and what you think you should do and the hours that you've put in and just sort of set that aside and approach it as you know, the novice character that you think, how you think your character would. That's difficult.
You know? Yeah, I don't envy you that, you know, like to set aside any part of being as great as you are to say, like, what would Rita the lounge singer, who maybe has not had the experience and maybe doesn't, to, you know, and then to know that maybe you're not going to sound exactly as great as you are. I don't know if I could do that.
I paid you to say that. Thank you.
No, I'm just imagining that scene, Joe saying, Karen, you sound lovely. Could you please turn the suck button up just a little bit?
Could you sing a little more out of tune? And maybe,
Well, I brought it up this morning because there's a part of Karen's voice that I know really well that I think, you know, that's something that's completely unique to her singular voice. And I hear it in moments and say, to me, that gives away a little bit that you know, you have a finesse, you've developed a finesse that's your own, that this character you know, hasn't had that kind of experience to have gotten there as a singular performer. But I should also say another thing that is analogous to, you know, in filmmaking apparently, and, you know, in record making, is that, you know, the idea that when we're our actual selves making records, that we're keeping it real, and now we're here kind of pretending. You know, it's all as phony as shit. I mean, it is.
Wait, what just happened?
Making records.
Bleep.
Bicycle. I'm just going to go ahead and tell everybody. Making records is just as phony as making movies. Yeah. And I mean that in the best possible way. It is all theater.
I wouldn't take that as a compliment.
You know, when you're sitting in a studio and somebody says, look, I just want to keep it real. I go, well, you know, leave my house, because there's nothing about this that's real. You know, that $10,000 microphone in front of you is not you keeping it real.
Yeah.
You know, that's us trying to create an illusion of some kind of, you know, sonic landscape, you know, on which the song might actually, you know, the story of the song is going to take place.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a part of what we do day to day as musicians that is about illusion, in the same way that making a film is about illusion. You know, people don't, you know, people don't care about the truth. People just want to be seduced. You know,
me, man, when it connects,
me, first among them, you know, I don't care anything about truth as far as like artistic truth. I want to be seduced.
But you want to be seduced by something that has the ring of truth. That
I want to be seduced by something that I believe is true.
Yeah, that's a Bob Dylan line he just said about his record.
This is very, very meta. But I mean, I agree with you, but I also think, I mean, making a record is stitching together moments of the true and real. It's, you know, I mean, they're degrees.
The songwriting.
I mean, it's sort of like the movie Social Network, which is virtually fictional, but there's a true thing in it that's not about like what really happened, but about, you know, it rings true. The dynamics all ring true. The story rings true in a way that is more impactful probably than, you know, than what actually went down.
Hey there, it's Kyle Meredith from Kyle Meredith With. After you check out the latest episode of my show, be sure to check out some of our other great programs on the Consequence Podcast Network, including Standing BTS, a bi-weekly podcast covering all things BTS and ARMY, and The Opus, Consequence's original documentary podcast exploring legendary albums and their lasting legacies. So head to consequence.net to listen to these podcasts and many great others.
Yeah, maybe I sounded flip when I said that I didn't mean to, because when I say that we're trying to, you know, that it's staged just as much as any film, I mean, I think sometimes you have to just sort of disappear into an idea, and it's not really about anybody's, you know, true reality. I mean, we're all referencing it. Anybody playing a role in a movie is still using, you know, I mean, your body is your instrument. It's your vehicle. It's the tool that you have. And yet you're still trying to, you know, create an illusion. Even if you've written a song that is based in, you know, a real moment of your life, there's a certain point when you're writing it, I believe, and of course we all have different philosophies about how we get there. But, you know, there is a real part of it for me as a songwriter that really is about disappearing into it. You know, I don't write a song to serve myself as a artistic persona. You know, my deepest desire is to write a song that is persuasive enough that I, Joe Henry, could disappear. I mean, period.
Well, now, it's interesting you put it that way, too, because all three of you have had, well, extremely great careers and very interesting careers. You know, all the paths you've taken, the control you have, all three of you, over your own career. You've tasted little bits of stardom.
Tiny morsels.
What do we call it?
Yeah.
At this point, and with
Stardust.
The control you have, though, is that ever...
The dust. Glitter.
Because this goes back to the John Doe character.
Deep
the John Doe character is trying to do a comeback. So it is that something, you know? Yeah. His character wants to do a comeback. You guys have, you know, whatever it's been, you've been there. Is that a thing? Is that when you're doing this, when you're talking about, you know, writing the song to disappear into, to connect, you know, someone else is going to take that and run away with it. But is it ever to be in that height of things again?
Are we aspirational to a fame?
It really is that kind of question, right? Yeah.
I think it's dangerous to set your sights on that.
Yeah.
And I'm not copping out. I think for me personally, my sights need to be set on discovery, and that's why I write. I write to discover, and if I just put my head down and focus on the work, that's a good place for me to live. Yep. If I start, you know, putting my head up in the clouds and looking around and wondering what if
yeah.
I lose sight of all the wonderful things that I have within my reach. So I'm really not copping out, but that's I really do believe that.
That's
but
beautiful.
It's taken me 45 years to get there.
Yeah, I think that's the absolutely. And even you know, even in smaller ways, like, how, you know, or is some, you know, is somebody going to like this song? Or, you know, suppose my friend hears this and thinks it's about, you know, like any the second you start thinking outside what is in front of you, you wander off the path. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yes, for me, I can't think about this. I don't even know mm-hmm. what fame means anymore. And in terms of what, you know, like as indie musicians, what we're doing. I mean,
right.
you know, do you really want to be on the, you know, the MTV Music Awards? I mean,
no.
My God, like,
I know.
Like, to have to worry about that.
It'd be great if all three of you were on
honestly,
the MTV.
Like, well, I can't think of a bigger nightmare at this point. Like, you know, that like, I'm just happy. Like, there's, you know, there's always, like, the next thing to do. Like, what's mm-hmm. the next thing to do? To
yeah.
make a record, to write a song?
Yeah.
Somebody calls you and says, do you want to be in a movie? I mean, you just say yes. You say yes to stuff, mm-hmm. and there's always going to be things to say yes to. Mm-hmm. Well, like, you know, God willing.
Well, when you get asked to do mm-hmm. something that's, I mean, aside from just getting up in the morning and just trying to write whatever song might, you know, offer itself, you know, in your path, you know, anytime I've been called to work on a song for a movie or produce something for a film, even if you do it and it doesn't get used, mm-hmm. you know, you still do something you would have never done otherwise,
mm-hmm.
and which is what's great about any kind of, you know, collaboration. You're asked to co-write with somebody or be in a movie like this. You know, you're being invited to engage in a way that you wouldn't have on your own,
mm-hmm.
and none of that's wasted. But as far as your question about, you know, fame and popularity and such, I mean, there's a real part of that. I mean, look, we've all been asked, if you're doing this professionally, to learn to value what you're doing by how many people are paying to hear it and how many people are showing up. And I'm just going to tell you that, you know, I've been seduced by that and demoralized by it as much as anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to tell you also that, you know, that's death to an artist.
Mm-hmm.
That notion mm-hmm. that, you know, what I'm doing has value
mm-hmm.
Only in as much as people immediately respond to it,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're finished.
Mm-hmm.
If I find myself writing a song and thinking about how mm-hmm. anybody's going to react to it,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's an imagined audience or my wife or my manager or my son or my brother, I'm done for the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're finished if you are already imagining how this is going to be received, because that's just become vanity at that point.
And you're already in the result, which mm-hmm. you have no control over.
No.
So you're already worrying and putting your energy into the part that
right.
you have zero control
right.
over instead of the part you have control over, right. which is finishing your song.
We do not sit on the results committee.
Yeah.
Nobody does. Yeah.
And might I say that that's really a great thing about the big crash of the record industry, if I may, that especially for people, you know, more like us than if you were sitting here talking to Sting, though why would you be talking to Sting? What I mean is that you know, there was a moment, you know, in the past when, you know, so-called AAA radio was supposed to be offering, you know, a slightly, you know, unguarded door left partially ajar for people like us. You know, only one of us, though, not all three of us would be allowed to walk through.
No,
you know, because there's only so much room in the lifeboat.
Yep.
But right. you know, the idea that
the rest of you
we all had to, we were all asked at some point to say, you know, hey, I love your record, but is there anything we can go to radio with? And at the point when it became as obvious to the rest of the industry as it was always obvious to me that I didn't really have a relationship to radio, stations like yours notwithstanding, because
thank you.
You guys have been mm-hmm. tremendously supportive.
Yeah.
And I would say that even if I wasn't sitting here in your town. But I'm saying, as a rule, you know, as soon as we didn't even have to pretend that a radio station was going to, you know, play a song of mine, I just speak for myself. And then if I gave it to them and it was a little bit faster and a little less sad ass, and if it was 3 minutes long instead of 9 minutes long, that they would actually play my records. Once I was able to stop,
mm-hmm.
Aware that people were not going to ask me to pretend that was true, mm-hmm. then I was completely liberated.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. you know, great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that never really existed for me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So let's stop pretending like it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now
yeah,
I can go do my work. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that, you know, one extra voice disappears from your head, mm-hmm, you know, that's some real clutter that's gone. Mm-hmm. Because yeah, that is not a,
picks up a lot that of real voice estate is not, that little voice
is not your friend when you're trying to create something.
No, you put it in a mason jar and screw the lid on and put it on the shelf and yeah, leave
absolutely
it there.
And it is amazing how infectious that can be, even if you, you know, even if you don't care about it or try to avoid it. Mm-hmm. I mean, just, and I was a little surprised because I went through, we talked about this before, but I went through a thing last year where I had someone close to me saying like, you know, I really hope your next record's going to be really different than your other records. And you know, I mean, I thought I was a person who was like, you know, I can shine on the opinions and the thoughts and, you know, desires of other people in, you know, in my work. But, you know, I mean, of course you're writing a song, you're like, oh, I'm really liking this song. I wonder if it's different. Is it different? Mm-hmm. Well, it feels, I think it's different, but is it different enough? What does different even mean? There's a lot of directions you can go in different.
Yeah.
Okay, does that mean like more sort of weird and indie? Oh, or maybe different means, and you just drive yourself crazy.
Yeah.
You know, as a person who's very yeah close to me and whose opinion I valued. Yeah. And,
sure.
You know, and I mean, I could not believe that I was having these thoughts. And it was really hard to get out of that because, you know, suddenly you're looking at yourself through somebody else's eyes.
Right.
And then once you do that, oh my God,
that's
it's
impossible.
Just murder.
Yeah.
That's
yeah
impossible. Was yeah this person from the Midwest by chance? Because when we say different back here, yeah, pal, you know what it means. Yeah. It means we don't understand that.
We don't understand.
No, but they,
as different.
They thought, you know, their opinion is that they thought I should go in a different direction. Yeah. And I'm like, I don't know what, you know.
Well, what does that even mean?
I was intending that this record would sound different than the last one, but yeah, you know, what does that mean? It sounds different to me, but maybe not to you. You know, I mean, you just maybe this is different in a bad way.
Yeah,
sure. Okay, yeah,
it's crazy.
You can
maker
see. Okay, I've, oh, yeah, also, so I've also had too much coffee at this point.
No, but you know, I completely hear you because yeah, you know, as yeah soon as you're thinking about, you know, what else it should be than what you would normally, you know, then where you would go creatively on your own, you know, listening to your own voice, yeah, and following it, you know, yeah, you're not in that same creative mode anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to adopt somebody else's on your behalf.
Yeah, you're
and you
trying
can't
to think
do
of somebody else's brain.
But I think the real, you know, one of the real beauties of being able to last long enough, you know, I had this talk with Michelle and DeGhiocciolo a few times where we were talking about Duke Ellington and the fact that some of my favorite music that he wrote was towards the end of his life. And you think, you know, in our racket, and it's harder all the time, you know, how do you sort of trick people into continuing to patronize you long enough to where you might actually get good at what you do? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm 51 and I've made a dozen mm-hmm records of my own, and I've worked on lots of other records, and I think I'm only now just getting to the point where I think I know mm-hmm what good might look like for me. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And there's a part of it we just say, you know, I'm old enough. I don't have to be all things to all people. Mm-mm. You know, you want to hear something, right, you know, more up tempo? Go put
preach
something
it
else on. There's
yeah
a lot of things.
It.
But
agreed.
There was a point when people yep would say, "I love your record. We need another upbeat song."
Yeah,
and
let,
I just
let
think,
them write it. Then.
That just doesn't.
That's right.
You know, I've liberated myself from that concern.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I just
right
think, you know, I don't care if the whole record's slow and in the key of D. It, you know, is it engaging to me? Do I keep wanting to go back? Does it tell the story? Is it the movie I wanted it to be? Mm-hmm. You know, as a full statement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really hard to get there unless you've been doing it long enough where you realize that all those kind of opinions, like mm-hmm Amy just described, are completely beside the point.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to hear that truth, you know, when you're younger and you're surrounded by people that you depend on, and you're like, only by the grace of this label or this publisher am I allowed to work.
Sure.
But, you know, in equal measure to the crash of the industry, you know, as we knew it, which I'm happy about it. It needed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's being met by mm-hmm a shift in technology that allows, you know, people to do all kind of work, you know, sitting in their apartment, sitting in their basement, you know, sure, wherever, who are not beholden to a record label to say, we are now going to give you a small amount of money to allow you to go do what you do. You know, you don't have to ask anybody's permission to go, you know, do what you do. And I love the idea of more and more artists being able to create something and then go to a label as an example and say, not here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I have done. Do you want to be involved?
Right.
And you're not offering them you know, a master pass key, you know, into your work. It's like, yeah, we want to do it, but we want to hook you up with this producer, though. You guys turn your headsets off for a second. Everybody needs a producer. You can't just go around by yourself making records in your basement without somebody guiding you. But anyway, for the young people out there who might
made
be...
made himself irrelevant.
It's really important that, you know, people are able to work, you know, without having to ask anybody's permission to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's been the big shift that people don't talk about when they talk about the great crash. Mm-hmm. You know, because what that really means, the great crash, is that people are, you know, hopefully not allowed to just live, you know, off of this crazy excess that just digs a bigger hole for everybody. Mm. And then what would look like a success, you know, in a reasonable world looks like failure. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something mm-hmm. T-Bone Burnett told me right. a long time ago. You know, Joe, yeah. you let people spend money on your behalf like this, even though when you're young, you think that means it's indicative of how much they believe in you. But they're just digging a hole that you may never climb out of.
Mm-hmm. They're just trying to keep their own jobs.
A new band that mm-hmm. sells 100,000 records, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. everybody ought to be popping mm-hmm. champagne corks. Mm-hmm. But if the label has spent, mm-hmm. you know, $3 million to make and market that record,
yeah.
you know, at the bottom of the printout sheet, you know, you just look like a disaster,
yeah.
and you're finished as far as that label's concerned. We've all seen it happen to people
oh, yeah.
that we know and love,
mm-hmm.
whose work didn't diminish, mm-hmm. but the perception of the work diminished because
yeah.
you know mm-hmm. the false stakes of the game were how they decided to determine success and failure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad
I'm sorry
you all
to go
have,
on and on.
You know, you're fine. I'm glad you all have stuck it out the way you did. I'm extremely thankful for all the music you've done, and more importantly, the way you've done it, because it really is noticeable out of here.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
The movie, Pleased to Meet Me, you're working on it. There's obviously, I'm guessing, no release date or anything like that, but we're going to keep mm-hmm. our ear to the ground on all of that, and I'm expecting a heck of a soundtrack, too. So.
Well, that's being talked about as well. I think that's part of Archie's master plan, mm-hmm. is that... Karen and Amy and I and John and Loudon will somehow do something once the movie is wrapped mm-hmm. that will be a companion piece, but hopefully also mm-hmm. you know exist on its own as a musical work mm-hmm. of integrity of some sort.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Well, thank you all so much.
Thank
for
you.
In here.
Thank you.
Thanks to the station for having us.
We're good, Brett. Cool. That was awesome. Next time we'll all do this again, and we'll just talk about other people's music.
Was that just going on and on?
No.
Was that babbling on?
Because of that right there?
Come on.
Yeah, I'm really jealous of that.
Yeah, you should be.
There's times where Karen and I would look at each other and go,
go. Yeah, well, I know.
Thumbs up.
I know.
I'm hopped up, too.
No, I'm glad you said everything you said. I mean,
Joe, come on.
This isn't a magazine interview, and, you know, it's not a
yeah.
a rock station interview
right.
or anything like that. So
no, it's great what you said.
I mean, we'll run it long
on.
Form. So.
Spot on.
I might edit out one word, but...
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
I apologize.
One fucking word.
I did a My thanks again to Amy Mann. The new album is called Queens of the Summer Hotel. And thanks to you for checking out this episode. Please do hit that subscribe button. Again, I put out 3 brand new interviews every single week, so it's a great way to keep up with all of your favorite artists, such as Amy Mann. And then after that, after you subscribe at all the usual places like iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, Podchaser, NPR, YouTube for the video versions, anywhere you get your podcast from, after you subscribe, head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, an hour full of song premieres, music news, anniversary spins, bonus interviews. It's Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on the social media spots. That's Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all 3 of them, at Kyle Meredith. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time. Consequence Podcast Network.
I also get like a very irritating latency sound.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.